For decades now, a lot of the effort toward addressing the disadvantages faced by Black men has been veiled with this sentiment of, that's not my problem, why don't Black men fix this? This sentiment surfaces again and again in the debates we're having on how to improve the outlook for African American men in America today. That the answer lies in their hands somehow. The new book is called Are Black Men Doomed? We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Cheer-Kent. The author of Are Black Men Doomed is Elford Young Jr. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Michigan. He's also author of The Minds of Marginalized Black Men, Making Sense of Mobility, Opportunity, and Future Life Chances. Elford, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Let's start with the title of your book. It's a question. So what are you probing here? What is your question getting at?
Well, I'm trying to really bring to surface this sense that the crisis for Black men and Black masculinity in America has loomed for such a long time that for some people, and including some Black men, there may be this sense that all hope is lost, that decades after the Civil Rights Movement, if these men are in the condition that they, that many of them happen to be in, that there's little to nothing that can be done. And my point in the book is to say quite directly, no, I don't believe Black men are doomed. They have survived the American experience. They'll continue to survive. But that any sincere effort for transformation involves not simply their own work for improvement, for advancement, but a societal readjustment and looking at who they are and how they live their lives.
Why men in particular?
Men in particular because as a researcher, I take very seriously the fact that social problems are complicated. And to try to take too big a bite means that you really don't get to understand the complexities, the nuances that pertain to any particular population. So I was born and raised in East Harlem in New York City, grew up amongst a number of struggling Black men, and really developed an acute sense of what was going on in their lives, the kind of advantages I had given my family circumstances in comparison to them, and really thought that I could offer something of an analysis and some kind of insight that would gain leverage on that issue.
So you decided, even as a young person growing up in East Harlem, that this is really where you wanted to put your life force, your career, into looking at this issue. So over the decades of your research, you and your team have interviewed hundreds of Black men. What have you asked?
I've been primarily interested not so much in the kinds of topics that seem to draw attention in the media and in public conversation, you know, what I have called and at other times the bang, bang, shoot 'em up perspective on Black men. You know, a lot has been said, a lot has been demonstrated about that kind of perspective. I wanted to know more about the kinds of conversations I had with men that I grew up with, which is, what do they think of as the good life? What do they think of as a good job? How do you access the good life? How do you access the good job? What are your beliefs, interests, goals, and family planning over time? The same kind of questions that all of us think about at some point in our lives, particularly when we're young, I knew that Black men were thinking about. They couldn't access these opportunities in the same way. They might not have imagined them in the same way as the rest of us. But having some insight into how they think and talk about these aspects of life, I thought brought a dimension that didn't quite surface in what I referred to earlier as the bang, bang, shoot 'em up kind of perspective on Black men.
Do you follow these men through life?
Some. Some it's very difficult to do so because of the changes that happen to them. I mean, they may be in and out of work. Some may be in and out of jail. So there's not a consistent pattern that would be exemplified, in fact, in my own life. I've been for 22 years now a professor at one university. I can't say that any man I've ever interviewed has had a consistent 22-year life experience. And so it's a challenge, too. But I've tried to, if not maintain contact with a number of the men, distant relatives, family members, social workers or professionals that are involved in their lives. And that hasn't been many. I'd say I can probably, with some degree of accuracy, document 10 to 15% of the several hundred men that have been in my research projects over the past two decades.
Let's talk about the image that's been cultivated of Black men often in the media. There are certain things that even well-intentioned people are not tend to turn to when thinking and talking about these individuals. You write about this culture of indictment when it comes to how Black males are viewed. What is behind this? What's going on?
Well, I think at this point in time, I'm saying now, 40, 50 years past the civil rights movement, there's been a firm crystallization of the image of Black men as being angry, hostile, threatening, non-cooperative. And there are certainly men out there who are angry, threatening, hostile, non-cooperative. But that imagery tends to override the reading of all Black men. And the point I make in the book, the point I've made in my career as a researcher, is that if you have certain economic or social resources, you can combat that imagery. I mean, I'm certainly in a position to do so. But for many struggling Black men, there is little they have to combat the public reading of them that is clear as soon as they walk down a street corner, as soon as they step into a business establishment. This is a general sense of if a man looks like he's struggling, like there's some economic challenge in his life, the immediate read is that this is a potential problem. And I think that is a overwhelmingly problematic condition for Black men to face, particularly if they don't have the economic resources to generate a different impression.
So an immediate stereotyping that is happening in brains.
Go ahead. I was going to say, we've seen this in some of the encounters that have happened in public spaces with Black men. So, the now classic story of Trayvon Martin is an individual that seemed like he was a problem walking down the block. And there were indications of how he dressed, the manner of walk, all that giving off cues that could have little or nothing to do with what a man's intentions are. But to have to think about how you walk down a block that's in a neighborhood that might not be your own is a telltale indication that there are problems that men face in the kind of public image that's attached to them.
Talking with University of Michigan sociologist Elford Young Jr. His new book is Are Black Men Doomed? We're talking about it on the morning show, getting your thoughts, your questions, your stories. 800-642-1234. Are you a Black man? What is life like for you here in Wisconsin? Have you lived in other places? How do those experiences compare? How do they add up? Do you feel like people of different races understand your perspective as a Black man? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Can you dig for us a little deeper here? What accounts for this public perception of Black men? Is it so deeply ingrained in people? Where did that come from?
Well, I think it emerges, first of all, in the post-civil rights era, when a certain image of Black urban life gained public attention. So, the sort of pre- and post-civil rights era moment, to simplify, is one where mainstream America began to pay attention and then take account of, and in some ways be very curious about Black urban life. And so by the 1970s, you have in media, in policy conversations, this turn towards the Black urban sphere that did not exist with that degree of intensity and focus. And in my view, a consequence of that became a reading of Black men, attention to Black men. And we had a crystallization in media, in cinema, and other sectors, this image of the aggressive, the assertive Black male, the Black man that didn't take any nonsense from people, and that would do whatever would take to get ahead. And that image both generated a sense of fear and anxiety, facilitated the social distance that's happened between Black and white Americans and urban America, but also intrigue. I mean, it was a case that this imagery was consumed in media and cinema and other venues. It was exacerbated, I think, by the rise of hip-hop era the culture and the kind of imagery that was associated with rap artists. Again, folks didn't necessarily want to be next to these people or engage with them in a sustained way, but consume the images through media, through television, and celebrate and promote the images of the gangster, the thug, so on and so forth. And so I think Black men by the 1990s were caught up in a unique contradiction in that a public image was so thoroughly embraced and consumed, but social connections were denied and feared. And that resulted in the image that still endures today of the aggressive, hostile black man that, you know, can sell a lot of records to white consumers if it's through hip-hop culture or hip-hop music.
University of Michigan sociologist Alfred Young Jr. writes that he spent the past 22 years in his research immersed in deep thought about whether the U.S. can ever come to terms with black men. And part of his conclusion involves a societal challenge that we as individuals need to re-educate ourselves about black males. We're talking about his new book, Are Black Men Doomed? Your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you a black man? What is life like for you in Wisconsin? Have you lived in other places? How do those experiences add up? We'll call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll return to the discussion after a news update on the Ideas Network. University of Michigan sociologist Alfred Young Jr. came of age in the 1980s. He is an African-American man. He was born and raised in East Harlem. He writes about how it was during this time in the 80s when young black males in the city were regarded as a social menace. That was the spark for him. That's what sealed his commitment to studying African-American men as a life pursuit. His new book out, it's called Are Black Men Doomed? We're talking about it on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Gathering your insights, your questions, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a black boy? How do you prepare your son to navigate the world? What do you tell him about his relationship with other people or the stereotypes he's up against? When do you tell him? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We have Kevin in Fitchburg who couldn't stay with us, and Kevin is looking at this as an entitlement issue. He wonders whether black men and white men do have the same opportunities or not. His question is, let me see if I can read it here. I can't quite read it. There we go. How do we know for certain that black men and white men do not have the same opportunities?
Well, we know quite clearly from the research of my colleague Deva Pager at Harvard University and others who did a series of studies, actually beginning in Milwaukee and then extending across the country, where resumes were issued to employers that indicated the racial background of potential employees. This is what's called an audit study or an experimental design where you simulate a process to see what kind of outcomes may be generated. And in this case, what her studies shown consistently from the Milwaukee studies through other studies across the country is that employers, upon getting identical resumes in terms of background, but with indicators in the documents that triggered whether the resume was from a white male or a black male, that consistently the white male was referred to for a callback interview. That happened for white males that reported having substance abuse problems at higher rates than black men who did not. That was found to be the case for white men who reported serving time in prison, more callbacks than for black men who did not. So in an experimental design where equivalent work experience was presented in resumes to employers, they still favored the white applicant over and against other factors that one would think would disqualify or minimize one's chances for success.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Evanda in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Evanda.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Well, I just came to talk about my experience as a black man living in Dubuque, an hour away. For the most part, I think to my face, I get treated fairly. But a lot of times, and I'm sure it's unintentional, from a lot of coworkers and even some of my friends, I feel misunderstood. Sometimes people might think that I'm going too far when they're using terms that are offensive to me. For instance, they might call my daughter mulatto. I am black. My wife is white. We have a mixed daughter. They don't know the history of the word, but they're basically calling my daughter a mutt, mulatto. So with different things like that, I don't think that they're meant to be facetious and to be in this way of offending me, but I feel like it's not that much sensitivity, because I feel like some white people here don't have a word that could be used towards them to offend them. So they wonder why I have the trigger words that offend me.
Evanda, may I ask you, you grew up in Louisiana and you now live in Dubuque, Iowa. How has that evolution been, moving from the Deep South to Iowa?
Yes. All right. So in New Orleans, if you go to certain communities, you can see the overt racism. But moving up north, I think that it's, at least from my experience, is more unintentional or behind my back. To my face, people are nice up north, but my wife is white, and if someone is conversating about her to about me, it might be something negative that could be taken to be racist, but when it comes to me, people just seem like nice people.
Professor Young, join in the conversation here. What do you make of what Evanda's observations are?
Well, he's giving examples of the very kind of phenomenon that I'm trying to touch upon in this book, which is that there are a set of preconceived notions that people have that they're not always critical or conscientious of. So whether it's, in this case, references to his child and not being aware of what terms mean, that's consistent with readings of black men and assuming, okay, there's a problem, there's an issue, or I have to be concerned about this individual, and not being in a place to recognize your response, to not challenge it, to not question it. I mean, it all comes back to an increasing need for all of us to be a little more conscientious and aware of why we have the initial responses we have to people that are different from us.
One criticism of your argument, I'd imagine, is that one could view it as absolving black men of responsibility when they do transgress. How do you respond to that?
I'm very clear. There is work to be done on multiple sides. I have never denied nor argued against the point that black men have work to do, continue to do some work. Others have work that they haven't begun doing. That involves being more productive, more functional citizens in a world, whether it's caring for children, responsible conduct in the public, so on and so forth. But the legacy of efforts by black men to improve themselves, to take advantage in a responsible and effective way of opportunities, has not erased this overwhelming stigma attached to them. And that reveals that there's other work to be done. So I do not deny that black men have had and must continue to do work. I critically call attention to the fact that the rest of us have work to do, too.
Let's go to Greg now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Greg.
Thanks, Kate. I'm a low-income white man living in an integrated neighborhood in Madison. And I know how hard it is to dig out of the economic hole I dug myself into. And I can't begin to imagine what it would be like to do that if I were black or had been in prison. So my question for the professor is to answer those questions he asked at the outset. How do black men see themselves? What's the ideal life for the black man, and how do they see themselves getting to that place?
Greg, thank you so much for joining in. Professor Young, go ahead.
Yeah, the first thing that the most struggling, the most socioeconomically deprived men that I talk to say is they want stability. And they may be so far removed from work or sufficient schooling opportunities that it doesn't even come down to saying what kind of job or what kind of school. They're desiring stability. And so this speaks to the distance some of these men have from meaningful, tangible opportunities. They may be able to work in lower-tier jobs that pay wages that barely allow them to sustain themselves or other relatives. They've had schooling experiences that they can't translate into meaningful mobility opportunities. So what might seem as an inability to argue for a future, an inability to make a case for what one wants to do, really boils down to them conveying to me in the course of research that I want some kind of stability. I want to be sure that I can earn a wage consistently over time. I want to see some possibility for moving up. And for some of these men, it's virtually impossible to see that when they're living in an environment where so few have experienced that.
We're having this conversation at a time when being a black man is seemingly enough to draw scrutiny from others. As you remember, two black men were arrested at a Starbucks last month while they were waiting for a business meeting. And that's just one of these high-profile examples among so many others. Where do you even begin to change, to try and change things, when skepticism over black men seems to be the lay of the land?
I think that the first critical step is increasing self-awareness. And I can't argue that this will be easy or even achievable for many people, but it has to occur for change to unfold. People have got to fully embrace and make sense of the fact that their preconceptions, the historical regard they've had for black men, plays a role in the circumstances that exist today. So the first is an honest accounting of self. The second step is to think carefully and responsibly about engaging, conversing with black men. There are so few opportunities to encounter black men as it is because they're not very visible in higher tier work environments. They're the kind of communities most disadvantaged black men live in are far removed from white Americans. But the extent to which in the workplace, in schools, in settings and sectors that provide you access to men, boldly engage them and get to understand them, not from the point of view of dictating to them who they should be and what they should do, but trying to understand who they are and what their interest is. I just don't believe enough national conversation is happening.
We're talking with University of Michigan sociology professor Alfred Young Jr. He's researched, traced the lives of nearly 500 black males over the course of his two decades of research. You can join in the discussion with your personal stories, your observations, 800-642-1234. Do you feel like people of different races understand your perspective as a black man? Why don't people realize, what don't they realize about growing up as a person of color? What do you want them to know? Call in or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to one of the stories in your book. You talk about a man who goes by the name of Blue. His story, you say, really represents the ultimate possibility of black men in the U.S. Can you give us a sense of who Blue is?
Yeah, you know, I met Blue in a happenstance moment. My then-fiancé, now spouse, and I were moving from Chicago to Massachusetts to finish our last year of graduate studies. And we had a husband and wife moving team that came to collect our materials, and that they had a day laborer with them, a gentleman named Blue. And I made nothing of this moment, save for some time during the packing of the materials. The truck driver commented about how effective Blue was in moving office materials. I mean, my wife's a professor as well. He accumulated a lot of books and bookshelves.
Lots of books.
And Blue seemed to be just very good at moving material. And I thought this was an interesting moment of a white male, a truck driver, recognizing the talent of a black male in that space. And I thought, I wonder what Blue thinks of this. So I figured during the lunch break, and Blue, you know, was sitting in what was now a half-empty living room, snacking on a sandwich, I'd ask him some questions, and I just simply said, I'd like to know a little bit about you. You know, how did you get into this moving business? You seem so good at it. And that's when he told me his story. And I thought, this is like so many stories I've heard, but outside of the context of a research interview or a research project, I got just a more free-flowing conversation. And he explained that, you know, he'd been a bad boy many years before. And his uncle, who was a mover, picked him up as a teenager and said, you're going to hang out with me for a while. You know, I'm going to show you a different life. And literally did. Put him in his truck, took him around the country as he was moving, and exposed Blue to a world he had not ever seen before. All he knew was the south side of Chicago. And over the course of a year, he was seeing small towns and different cities. And you could just see Blue's face lighting up as he was telling me the story, how he came to understand different parts of America through this experience. And that just set him on a different course. You know, he was a day laborer with a moving company, hoping to one day be in a position to be a truck driver, a truck owner himself. And to see a guy who had, he had a plan. I mean, everything I said that many black men lack, he had a plan.
Mm.
Now, it's hard to achieve it. I get all that. But just this encounter with the uncle took him out of a place of where he used to be to putting him in a situation where this white truck driver could recognize this guy as a valuable worker, when a decade ago, he might have just been another one of those social menaces on the streets of Chicago.
So Blue was given a chance. Did you see this type of story, this type of through line in your other interviews of being given a chance?
On occasion, I've had opportunities to interview men who've been released from prison, who've had internship programs, others who have been connected to social programs. And what they simply learned is how to move from where they are to where they want to be. Lots of guys have dreams, and even if it's a very simple dream of I want stability, you know, I want a consistent income. But understanding how to make the connection between where you are and where you want to be is the harder work. Oftentimes people say, well, you know, black males are too focused on athletics, and they spend too much time focusing on the fast and quick way of getting ahead. Well, if that's the only pattern you've seen in your neighborhood, that's all you know. It doesn't mean you necessarily believe that athletics is ideal for you or the best way in the world. It's the pattern you've seen. And they've certainly seen more of that than people like me coming out of neighborhoods becoming professors.
Let's go back to the phones now with Rick joining us from Park Falls. Hi, Rick. Hi, Rick. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Oh, am I on the air?
Yes, you are, Rick. Go ahead.
Okay. What I wanted to say is that with all the formal constraints against blacks that have been removed by various pieces of federal legislation, the one area I think that is most important to still holding them back is what's called the monster, quote-unquote. What that is the rate of black-on-black homicide in all of our big urban centers, and it's most striking, I would say, in South Central Los Angeles, where in the beginning of the 1990s, in a three-year period, there were more than 6,000 homicides. And what this is primarily, it's a failure of the government to maintain its monopoly on violence.
And Rick, I want to stop you right there to get Alfred's opinion on black-on-black crime.
I certainly agree that it's a critical issue. I also understand as a sociologist that most violent crime that's committed in America is committed by people against people they either are intimately connected with or have social connections to. So most crime inflicted upon white Americans is by other white Americans. It certainly hasn't generated the public attention or the concern, but the fact of the matter is people don't travel far and wide to inflict violence upon other people. It tends to be people in your community. So there's an organizational dynamic as to why this phenomenon of black-on-black crime appears to be so unique. It may be unique in the proportion. It's not unique in the occurrence. That's the way violent crime happens in America. Now, having said that, I think, one, we had to pay attention to, there are some very different, very big differences across cities in what's going on. You know, Chicago, Los Angeles, others have had consistent problems. New York has had a dramatic decline.
And we have to pause right. Yeah, we have to pause right there. We're going to get back to that conversation with University of Michigan Sociology Professor Alfred Young Jr. You can join in 800-642-1234. Your questions, your observations. Do you feel people of different races understand your perspective as a black man? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back after a news update. The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The book is Are Black Men Doomed? We're talking with author Alfred Young Jr., who's a professor of sociology at the University of Michigan. He writes how it's unfortunate for many black men who have had troubled pasts that they lack the capacity to freely recreate themselves because he says, here's the thing, their trajectory requires something that is out of their full control, that is, other people must commit to seeing black males in a new light, that black men can't fully fix the setbacks that they'll encounter in our society today. Gathering your questions, your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. Are you a black man? What is life like for you in Wisconsin? Have you lived in other places? How do those experiences compare? And how do you think the media shapes how you view black men? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Professor Young, you were wrapping up some thoughts on black-on-black crimes in New York, specifically seeing a dramatic reduction of such crimes. Do you want to wrap up that thought?
Yeah, just my final point was that we need to study why there seem to be these extreme differences across cities and what's going on there. And that's before us now, because it's so inconsistent across cities that, you know, we owe some deep investigation to be able to make sense of this very important phenomenon.
Sarah from Zion, Illinois, called in. She says she's a substitute teacher from kindergarten through eighth grade. And Sarah notices students of color struggle as they grow older. She says white teachers expect black children to behave poorly because some do, and educators need to check their assumptions because that's not fair. What do we know what's happening in education, in classrooms?
Well, what we know is that's a core site for the kind of activity that I've been discussing that happens more generally, which is a set of perceptions, expectations, understandings drive the interaction that happens on an everyday basis. So black children, black boys in particular, are perceived to be potential problems, uncommitted to the learning experience, difficult in the classroom, and anything they do, explicitly or implicitly, that triggers or reinforms that understanding just exacerbates problems. And, you know, any child can have a bad day. Any child can be upset on a given day. Any child could not desire to do a certain assignment on a given day. But the consequences for black children, black males in particular, responding in that way, are just a reaffirmation of a negative image.
Let's go to Pat now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Professor, I work for an organization that teaches a lot of black teens in the high school environment. We have very rich experiences, but I have times when I'm very troubled and I guess almost feeling sad. I see a lot of behavior that I want to try to understand better or why these young people act like they do from a language standpoint or just even their time in the hall or respect in the classroom. And again, our job is to try to educate them, and we want them to feel good about their future. But I'm looking for advice on how to engage and have dialogue with them about, I guess, how they're feeling, maybe why they're acting like that.
Thank you, Pat. Professor Young, go ahead.
I wonder if you've had opportunities to share with them your feelings, your concerns, and not in a hostile or threatening way, but even to begin the conversation with, you look like you're having a bad day. I have bad days too. Here's what it means for me. Help me understand what it means for you. And so, you know, to in some way create a level playing field. I think too often, again, the assumption is that there's something unique or different about their mood, their attitude. The behavior may seem unique or different, but the core feelings are in some ways just like the rest of us. So to try to invite that conversation, do so in a way that still protects and promotes what your achievements are in the place you're working. And I get it's challenging work. I'm not going to try to pretend that I know what it's like to engage that every day. But to have that twofold, here's what you're here for, here's what I'm trying to deliver to you, but I understand that as people, we feel differently on a given day. Here's why I feel bad about something, and this is why. Let's try to understand what's going on with you. And it may take a series of interventions over time with the same person. It may take a series of conversations over time. But that's my recommendation.
Pat, thanks. Let's go to Angela now in southeast Wisconsin. Hi, Angela.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just want to explain my experience. My son is of mixed race, and his father is actually...
Angela, you're fading in and out. Can you speak directly? Yeah, great. Go ahead.
Sure. Okay. I'm a white lady, and my son is of mixed race, and his father is Black. And I just wanted to say, you know, my empathy and experience of this. And I feel even as a white woman being suppressed in society, I've worked for an automotive place and a landscaping place with primarily all males, okay? And so therefore, I feel like at times it's a mind frame of the suppression because people project their inadequacies to you, whether you're white or you're Black, and they do that because of their own problems within themselves. So the whole thing is, I would say, confidence in the beginning of their life. So when your child is young, having the father present is very important. And then the confidence that you say to your child, you can be somebody and you're going to be somebody. There's no exceptions to that. You're going to go to college and this and that and bring them up. And we need teachers and we need mentors to step up and tell young Black women and men that they are equal and they can do whatever anybody else can. And then in your mind frame, you do not accept any of this negative projection, because even as a white woman, I get it every single day because I'm a white woman working in this men's world. You know what I mean? So the whole thing is that, you know, this is a kind of a funny story. I'll keep it short. But, you know, when my son was young in kindergarten, you know, he's of mixed race. You can't really tell what race he is. Well, a white boy was saying to a Black girl, you know, something about Black people have no money, blah, blah, blah. And Levi said, "Excuse me, have you ever heard of Martin Luther King Jr.? And my dad just bought me a PSD for Christmas." In the game, you know, so it's like you teach your children to have confidence, to stick up for themselves, to stick up for their friends, and things like that. And it starts at a young age. And the whole thing is that, yes, things are not fair out there. And America is tough. It is rough. And it is not fair for white women and Black women and Black men and Mexican. You know, it's, the whole thing is that.
Yeah, and
you know,
Angela,
that have a beautiful heart and soul, that were raised right. And the whole thing is that it's not fair. But you have to have that confidence.
Angela, we're short on time, but Professor Young, what about raising Black boys with confidence?
I think that's critically important, to demonstrate and promote confidence, but also demonstrate, promote, and provide comfort and security when things go wrong or when there are problems that unfold. Black males need the capacity to communicate to their parents, to their friends, to other people, when they're feeling insecure, when they're feeling vulnerable, when they're feeling uncertain. And too often, those kind of expressions are denied Black males, or they're put back upon Black males as, that's not the way to behave, you're a man. We need to create spaces where they can articulate and develop comfort with being insecure, being vulnerable, and getting the support and guidance to manage that. Confidence and support.
Does that go along the lines of challenging societal assumptions about masculinity and what it means to be a man?
Indeed, indeed. Because a lot of what's going on for Black men results from the fact that there aren't spaces to work out, to reconcile moments of insecurity, anxiety, anguish. And so it appears again as that threatening, hostile individual. Some folks are troubled and need some intervention and need safe spaces to work through those things that are troubling them, and that too often is not provided to them.
Let's look at Wisconsin for a moment here. According to the 2010 census, only 6.3% of the state's population identifies as African American. And because of that, there are communities where the Black population is very small, if it even exists. So how do people in a state like Wisconsin do what you're talking about, especially if they may not see or interact with Black men on a daily basis?
Well, the first thing is to realize that having that social distance, that extreme distance, means you are highly susceptible to then determining that the public imagery, the stereotypes, the stigmas, are all that there is for this population. This is a wonderful state to really begin to consider that first step of thinking, rethinking, how you understand these people, right? And know that there may be very sporadic occasions of encountering them, of dealing with them, of having conversations with them, but try to take advantage of them, try to be aware of what's going on when those moments occur. So being distant doesn't mean that you are removed from the problem. You're more susceptible to embracing or having these problematic understandings.
distance.
All you have is the image.
Distance doesn't mean being disengaged.
Right.
What else needs to happen going forward?
I think ultimately for communities, for people that have more connections, that are more involved, a willingness to engage in a different way. It doesn't mean that we create a new stereotype and say that there are no problems and, you know, every black man can be my friend, right? Think and respond in the way in which you would respond to anyone else, which is a diversity of personalities, opinions, behaviors, some you'll like, some you won't like.
And what about this capacity for transformation? That
I think ultimately it comes out of a desire to engage differently. In public encounters, in the workplace, in schools, we have to have different patterns of engagement across all of these spheres. And it means change will take time. I won't deny that, but we've got to commit ourselves to it.
Do you ever get perhaps tired of your research? Do you see change?
In some small ways. I'm disappointed by the consistency of the problem that's endured from the day I started formal research over 20 years ago to today. And had a colleague tell me, in fact, a few months ago, you know, that's the same argument you made in the 90s about black men. So I think the movement has been very slow. But we've had moments to really think seriously about what's going on. The recent conversations about the Starbucks moment, the interactions of the police force with black males. One of the true jewels of social media is that there are images that are presented across the country that other folks just didn't understand. I would imagine that without seeing images of black men in Starbucks or some of the other settings, that folks would say, oh, this could have happened, or it couldn't have happened that way. Now we can see, even if we're not there, that things can happen a certain kind of way.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Alfred Young Jr. is a professor of sociology at the University of Michigan, author of the new book, Are Black Men Doomed? This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina, Keely Baltina, and Brianne Shasso. Michael Derringer provided technical support. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.